And so I thought that that was critical information to put out there. Like, if you have a darker skin, if you're a darker skin person, they might think that you're Haitian and you might get treated a certain way. And then if you're white and blonde hair, you're going to stand out like a sore thumb and they're going to think you're rich and they might treat you a certain way. And then if you're like me in the middle, like a tan skin person, it just depends, depending on your hair texture, how you might be treated.
I'm Felina Jean, and this is Black Broads Abroad. I'm an international woman of leisure who said peace out to the United States in 2011, and I have not looked back except at this ass, honey. Since then, I've lived on 4 continents, but traveled to over 40 countries. Along my journey, I've come to know some very compelling Black women from all over the world who also said fuck you to their comfort zones. I created this podcast to inspire Black women in the diaspora to take risks and live their very best lives. Stephanie Clater is the author of Black Trekking, My Journey Living in Latin America, a riveting coming-of-age story profiling Stephanie's decision to move to a foreign country by herself, not just once, but twice. From the time Stephanie was a baby, she spent summers on family vacations exploring the United States with her family. As she became an adult, she made the decision to live abroad and learn Spanish. From love and heartbreak to violence, culture shock, and exploration of racial identity, Stephanie details her time blossoming into an adult while living in the Dominican Republic and Colombia. This moving travel memoir weaves in tips for how to stay safe while living abroad, as well as how to have a good time and maximize the experience. A natural inquisitive storyteller and an award-winning multimedia reporter by trade who has worked at numerous television stations across the United States, Stephanie put her journalism skills to work and shares never-heard-before interviews from displaced Colombians and from members of Maroon communities. She intertwines the stories of others who have fought for years to be recognized. Many of her adventures will have you laughing and reflecting while simultaneously inspiring you to walk away with a greater understanding of Dominican and Colombian culture. Welcome, Stephanie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being patient with my African Wi-Fi. So we came into each other's orbit actually through Instagram. You reached out to me and I see that you have this very compelling memoir that you've recently published, and it traces your coming of age story as an expat in the Dominican Republic and Colombia. How did you come to be a Black broad abroad, and what led you to those countries in particular?
The main goal for me was to become fluent in Spanish because I knew I wanted to be a journalist, and I knew that there would be a need for that in the future to be able to communicate not only in English and in Spanish. So I went to Puerto Rico first when I was in college. I loved it. And my roommate was Dominican. And she said, well, Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic are kind of similar. Maybe you should go there. So I signed up to go to Dominican Republic to study abroad. I had an interesting time there. It was definitely life-changing. And I felt that I still wasn't fluent in Spanish. And so when I came back, I decided and I applied for a Fulbright English teaching Black population there that I wanted to learn more about. And one of my friends had went and he's like, Stephanie, it's amazing. Like, they're very proud to be Black. Like, you've got to go check this out. And so I applied to go to Colombia and do just that, study the Afro population as well as teach English. And I got the Fulbright. And so that's how I ended up in Colombia.
Oh, I love that. I like that in your book, you explore the not so rosy side of being an expat. And I say this every episode, but there's a profound difference between being a tourist and a traveler, and even more of a difference between vacationing in a place and living in a place. So people often see like nouveau travelers flexing on Instagram, but life happens everywhere. And in your book, you share some very personal stories of love and heartbreak and violence. Can you share some of the personal things that you experienced living in Colombia and the Dominican Republic?
So when I lived in Colombia, they were still involved in a civil war. It was happening mostly in the rural areas and not in the big cities, but there was still a threat. And so the first week they inaugurated a new president, and soon after there was a car bomb that went off. And the car bomb that went off, it basically bombed a radio station. And so that said to me that journalists weren't safe in this country, which was scary because at the heart of things, I had studied journalism and considered myself a journalist. So that was alarming. But at the same time, I wasn't going to let that scare me and have me leave the country. Definitely learn how to not be naive in Colombia. There was a lot of safety measures that I had to do just in order to keep myself safe. Just more so of like, you know, I didn't have a car, so I was walking and using public transportation and just being hyper aware of my surroundings so that people didn't pickpocket me or that type of thing. So that was Colombia. And then in Dominican Republic, you know, you see the pictures on the beach and you think like, oh, they're having such a great time. But living there is a different story. And again, I didn't have a car. So to get around, I had to use their public cars, which would be equivalent of like an Uber rideshare. They actually had that going on back in 2008, but they call them conchos with six other people. So imagine three people riding up front and four people riding in the back with no air condition. Ooh. And that's how I got around. So it's little things like that we take for granted. Culture shock, but you adapt, you get used to it, and you move on with life.
So the Dominican Republic has a long history of colorism and discrimination against Haiti, which is my native homeland. So, and they also share the same island, but their long history of discrimination against Haitians is one of the reasons I don't support the Dominican's tourism economy. How did you confront racial identity politics in the Dominican Republic?
And it was a very complex issue for me because I felt like I was kind of caught in the middle as an African American, but a light-skinned African American. And so you're there, and you know, my friends are all different shades that were Americans. And you come to realize, like, depending on how you look, you're going to be treated differently in Dominican Republic. Like, that's just a fact. And so I wrote an entire chapter called Skin Tone Matters, where it talks about, you know, depending on what shade you are, what situations might arise. And even for white people, because if you're white in Dominican Republic, you're more of a target because they think that you're rich. And so, you know, people will try to rob you. And so you can't go everywhere that other people might be able to go because you're seen as a target. And so I thought that that was critical information to put out there. Like, hey, you know, if you have a darker skin, if you're a darker skin person, they might think that you're Haitian and you might get treated a certain way. And then if you're white and blonde hair, you're going to stand out like a sore thumb and they're going to think you're rich and they might treat you a certain way. And then if you're like me in the middle, like a tan-skinned person, it just depends, depending on your hair texture, how you might be treated, or what you're wearing.
Hair texture is really a part of their identity politics. And I think you had a story about an experience you had with hair there. Can you expound on that a bit?
Yeah. So I had a friend who is maybe like a caramel complexion colored, but she had long, beautiful hair. But she's a Black American, and she didn't get a relaxer. Her hair was natural. She chose to blow dry it. And so we all know what that looks like. It's kind of, you know, frizzy, but like long. And she said she went to the club and they told her, you need to put that in a ponytail if you're going to come to this club.
the nerve.
Yes, they just don't play. Now, this was a nicer club, probably more of where lighter Dominicans would frequent. But there are also clubs that are like, they call them like Rancho Tipicos, where you dance merengue all night. And they're probably where more of the lower class, less affluent people go.
And so I don't know heads are allowed at the exclusive clubs, what I surmise from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like class and race.
Oh, my goodness.
Class and race. But, yeah, like the affluent clubs, they have their dress code. And I guess they don't have any qualms about stuff that we would we would never say, they don't have any qualms about telling you what look that you must have to enter, apparently.
Yeah, the irony is that, like, Dominicans give the best blowouts anywhere on the planet, hands down, they have the best blowouts. But I think that, like, some of the like psychosomatic traces of colonialism, especially, I don't know, Spanish colonialism manifested itself in a way that, like, I mean, colonialism is colonialism, but I just see like a lot of very insipid self-hatred with Dominicans in that way. Cause they have the same, if they were to get a perm, they would have the same no-lie relaxer as us. They nappy at it too. And slave ship.
And I talk about it in the book. There.
Yeah, just like they did everywhere else in the diaspora. So you have a whole chapter in the book dedicated to this?
Yeah, I break it all down. Like this whole idea of what they call is blancamiento, but it's the whitening of the race. And that is like a real thing in DR. Like not everyone in Santo Domingo, you'll see more darker skin Dominicans, but I would definitely say in Santiago, like there's this idea of just trying to look whiter. So if you weren't born that way, then you go to the salon and, you know, they could straighten your hair. They can dye it blonde and you can just they'll do whatever you want to make yourself look whiter. And so that's like a big thing. Like I would come back from the beach and my host mom, who happened to be a lighter skin Dominican with straighter hair, she would say, like, you going to the salon? Like, you going to do something with that hair? Like, I'm like, no. So it was just very interesting to, like, live in this environment. But, yeah, you just kind of take notes and write it down in your journal. Like, this is what's going on here. And because of me kind of, like, being in the middle, I was privy to all the conversations. Like I had friends who were Haitian who would tell me what would happen.
You was passing out there the oddity.
I mean, I'm just in the middle. So yeah. The Haitians would tell me stuff and then I'd be in the room with Dominicans and they would just say things that they wouldn't say around Haitians and be like completely honest about their thoughts. And then I had like my American friends that are like, yo, like this is what happened to me when I try to go to the club or, you know. So just like, I guess, I don't know, my position, I was able to just document all of these things.
Yeah, you mentioned that one of the requisite classes that you all took was like Dominican-Haitian relations. It seems like the curriculum was very well curated. That seems like essential learning if you're going to have an immersive experience in the Dominican Republic. So you've also lived, go ahead.
Oh, I didn't know if you wanted me to talk about that class or not.
Sure.
I think it was really interesting because there was Americans, both white and black in that class, Haitians and Dominicans. And so we learn about the history and like why, like what led to these two countries not getting along and the people and what was kind of the message that was passed down. And when you learn the history, you learn that close to the Haitian border, there was a Dominican dictator, Rafael Trujillo, who had a Haitian grandmother and literally decided that he was going to go and he killed people. He ordered his military to go kill.
His grandmother was Haitian.
I'm pretty sure I read that. He had a Haitian ancestor.
That's crazy. That's like who?
And he went, you know, the whole thing of self-hate. Yeah, and so he ordered the military to go and kill like 15 to 30,000 people. If they couldn't say parrahil and roll their R, which is parsley, then he figured they couldn't speak Spanish. They must be Haitian. And if they were darker skin, they were ordered to be killed. And so you had that happening. That's how it got passed down, this idea of like, of anti-Haitianism or like, I don't want to appear Haitian. Because in that period in the 1930s, people were getting killed. And so that's kind of how I guess it started where, well, maybe it didn't start then, but definitely increased of like, I need to appear as Spanish as possible. And it just got passed down, these ideas. But a lot of it during the era that he was in charge.
Wow. Yeah.
And I guess because of self-hate, because he himself didn't want to be Haitian.
It's so crazy. Oh gosh. Like just the vestiges of colonialism is just, it's so insipid how it rears its ugly head. But you also lived in Colombia, and Colombia has about 3 million Afro-Colombians, and they make up about 7% of the population. And in my own travels, I've noticed a pattern of disenfranchisement of darker skinned people all over the world. Are Afro-Colombians similarly marginalized by greater society from your observations?
And so what I would say is that Colombia also is complex and has a complex history. So I would say on the northern coast, you have a lighter skin, more mixed, I would still call them Afro-Colombian. They're like light, they look like light skin Americans. They look like Dominicans. But they are on the northern coast in Cartagena and Barranquilla and Santa Marta. But then outside of one of the first freed slave towns in the Americas called San Basilio Slave, who escaped to this town and created their own community, their own language and traditions and customs, and they've maintained it to this point. They actually became their own freed slave town in 1691 from the Spanish crown. They kept defeating the Spanish to the point where the Spanish gave up and said, okay, you can have your own land and do your own thing. So you have that going on in northern Colombia. And then on the western coast, you have, it is pretty much all black, some of the people who were brought over and enslaved, and they ran away from the ranches in the middle of the country and moved to the coast, the Pacific coast. And so you have that going on. They refer to themselves as the Pacificos, or people from the Pacific coast. And what you have is now the civil war that happened in Colombia is mostly what's happening in this area on the western portion of the country, which is mostly rural, but also has a lot of the natural resources. And so during that war and like guerrilla warfare, a lot of the Afro-Colombians were displaced. And they had to move to the bigger cities of Bogota and Medellin. And so you will see Afro-Colombians in these cities, and you would probably think they were disenfranchised in some of the poor neighborhoods. But a lot of it has to do with where they came from. I mean, they literally had to pack up their bags and leave. So they weren't able to bring a lot with them, and where they came from, they lived off the land. They weren't used to having to work in corporate offices or things of that nature, the majority of them. And so they, you know, have a hard time living in these cities, but they had to because of violence and being forced to. So I would say that's kind of where the disenfranchisement comes. And I know a lot of the good jobs in the big cities in Colombia, you know, they require you to speak English and have a college education, which are all things that are very difficult to obtain for these populations in many cases. And back where they come from, a lot of them, that's not what they did. So it's a real struggle for them. So I interviewed a man who had, he came from one of these communities, and I just talked to him, like, what is life like living in Bogota, having to flee from violence? And so, and I got to see where he was living, and it was not very nice. It was a real struggle for him to find a job and to be paid fairly. Like, he told me he'd do work, construction work, and they wouldn't pay him at the end of the job.
At all?
Like, things like that were happening.
At all?
Yeah, he said they do the job, and then they're like, oh, yeah, we're not paying you.
These are citizens?
Yeah, that's what he told me.
These are citizens?
He's Colombian.
Man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy for
and
anyone,
I would say,
but much less if you're a citizen. Wow. So as a, you mentioned the Maroons, and as a journalist, you've done some research on Maroon communities, which really excites me because my matrilineal ancestors were Maroons in the Blue Mountains of Jamaica. So what Maroon communities have you visited in the diaspora? And can you explain a little bit to the audience about who the Maroons are?
So Maroon communities, my understanding, are basically the descendants of enslaved people that escaped and were able to create their own communities and be independent. And so the one that I visited that now is really popular and a lot of people are traveling to, but it's called San Basilio de Palenque. And they call themselves Palenqueros, but they have their own language and they live about an hour south of Cartagena. And basically they were able to escape and create their own community. And they brought other people who were enslaved to this community and they are still there today. And a lot of tourism happens there now. It didn't so much when I went back in 2010. But that's pretty much the gist of that. I would recommend that people visit them. You'll see a lot of the women, they're known for having the fruit on their head and they do that type of thing to get money in Cartagena, like take pictures with tourists and that type of thing.
Oh, okay.
But those are the Palenquera women. Yeah. But they have their own, like, it's amazing just to see how they've been able to maintain their culture and their language.
And when were they established?
Since 1691 is when they got their independence from the Spanish crown.
Wow.
So the fact that they have been able to maintain their community for that long is just amazing.
Hmm.
Their food, and I mean, definitely the language.
Hmm. What's the biggest lesson that you've learned about stepping outside of your comfort zone?
I would say just stepping out of my comfort zone gives you amazing self-confidence because every day that you live abroad, it is a challenge and you're facing things that happen in life, but in a different language. So it is an extreme challenge just to get through normal activities that you would do back at home. But the confidence that you have when you return is just incredible because, you know, if you can get through 10 months of living in Colombia and extreme culture shock, you can do anything when you come back to the United States. And I feel like that confidence will carry you through, you know, any situation that you encounter. So I feel like most people should study abroad.
What advice do you have for Black women that are thinking of leaving their home country and starting an expat journey?
The advice I have would be to do your research. And definitely, I would encourage you to reach out to other women who have been to those countries. Because when I was deciding, I had some friends who had went to Spain and they told me it wasn't a pleasant experience. So that's kind of how I checked that off my list. But I would definitely say reach out to people who've lived there, who maybe have family there or know something about the culture. So at least you're aware of what you're getting yourself into. And so that would be my advice, is to read up and research and reach out to people who've been to those countries.
Where can people keep up with you and your projects and follow you on social media?
You go to blacktrekking.com /book. You will see the link to order the book. Also, it's sold on Amazon, so you can check it out there, but it's called Black Trekking, My Journey Living in Latin America. And you can also follow me on Twitter and on Instagram and Facebook. Just look up Black Trekking. And if you want to reach out to me, you can always email me, blacktrekking@gmail.com. So check out the book and check out the travel blog.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, for your time. Shout out to our Patreon members for your support. If you too are interested in joining the Black Broads Abroad movement, you can follow us on social media, and that's BlackBroads. That's on Instagram and Facebook. And if you'd like to become a supporter on Patreon, you can do so on patreon.com/blackbroadsabroad.